That's the most dramatic one of that year, 2010. Okay, let me show you some stills here. And what's remarkable about the sun is that let me pull this back up. What happened here? Well, I'll just move on. I was going to show you some more still slides. Well, no, I think I will show you one because it shows what's called a coronal mass ejection. Here we go. Ah. This is what's called a coronal mass ejection, where you get a very powerful flare and it shoots out a strong magnetic burst. And that hits the Earth. It has some significant consequences. We can turn the lights back on now. What's interesting about, you know, you've seen these videos in the slide. It's a good thing we're not any closer to the sun. If we were any closer to the sun, these flares would basically make human civilization impossible. I'll explain why in a minute. But if we were any farther away from the sun, there wouldn't be enough energy and wind coming out of the sun to stop us from being killed by cosmic rays. That's one of the fine-tuned features of our planet Earth. We're not so close to the sun that the solar radiation kills us, but we're not so far away from the sun where the solar wind doesn't adequately shield us from being zapped by cosmic rays. We're just the right distance. And the other thing we notice is that we happen to be orbiting a star that has the minimum flaring activity. If the sun were any smaller in its size, we'd have more flares. If it was any bigger, we'd have more flares. Stars that are the same size as the sun have the minimum flaring. But the other thing we notice is if the sun were any younger, we'd have more flares. If it was any older, we'd have more flares. And I got a graph here to show you the flaring history of the sun from the time of its birth through the present and on into the future. And this shows you that we happen to be living, that dotted line represents where we are right now. We happen to be living on Earth when the sun has the minimum flaring activity. And just to give you a context here, the vertical scale is logarithmic. There's a factor of a million between the greatest flaring activity and the minimum flaring activity. And you say, well, how did life survive a few billion years ago? Well, a few billion years ago, all you had were microorganisms. And microorganisms are much more tolerant for solar flaring activity than plants and animals, and ones that is least sensitive of all is us human beings. And this research paper begins by pointing out what are the consequences if we were to have one of these coronal mass ejections hit our magnetosphere. And that actually happened in 1859. In 1859, there was a coronal mass ejection just as powerful as this one that hit our magnetosphere. This one happened in 2012, but it missed. It did not come anywhere close to the magnetosphere of the Earth and did us no harm. But in 1859, it shut down telegraph systems around the world, actually caused some telegraph poles to catch fire, and telegraph operators were being shocked by the electricity running through the telegraph wires. Everywhere people saw spectacular northern lights. In fact, it was so spectacular that people living in the state of Maine could read a newspaper by the light of the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights. And then there's a story of miners in the state of Colorado who got up 2 hours early because they thought it was dawn and actually had breakfast a couple hours earlier than they normally did. And I personally have seen the aurora when I was doing astronomy in Canada so bright that we had to shut down the telescope. I mean, you literally couldn't see stars because of how bright and colorful and moving, that we just basically shut down the telescope and watched the equivalent of a spectacular laser show for the rest of the evening. So yeah, they're great to see, they're beautiful, but they also can disrupt communication. And my sons asked me a little while ago, well, Dad, what would happen if we had another event like the one in 1859? And I said, well, number one, it would probably knock out several GPS satellites, to which they responded, that would be the end of civilization as we know it. But I said, it would also probably temporarily knock out the internet. Telephone communication would be affected. But the worst consequence is it would shut down the U.S. power grid for at least 20 million people, maybe as many as 50 million people, and would shut it down anywhere from a minimum of 16 days to 2 years. And, you know, not having electricity for a two-year period, you would have to move. I mean, our American society today is vitally dependent upon that. Now, in tree rings, we see the record of a coronal mass ejection in 775 AD that was 5 to 10 times bigger than the one that happened in 1859. And if that were to happen today, it would knock out the European and North American electric power grids for about a two-year period. And that would mean that the U.S. population would have to drop to 10% of where it is right now. Because without electricity, we can't sustain 340 million people. We can sustain 34 million, which gives you an idea why 1859 wasn't that big of a deal. We didn't have that large of a population back then. Today we do. And of course, it'd be even more devastating for Europe than it would be for the U.S. And what this paper determined is that for stars like the Sun, that happens once every 2,000 years, which would make it a significant risk for human civilization. And incidentally, there are things we can do. The real problem is when you get one of these events, it knocks out all the transformers in the electric power grid. And because these things are so well built and last so long, there's a very low manufacturing capability for these transformers. In fact, none of them are manufactured here in the U.S. We import them. But hey, we import maybe a dozen a year. If you knock out the power grid, you're going to need literally tens of thousands, if not 100,000, and there simply isn't the manufacturing capability. And so one of the things this paper is suggesting, maybe what we need to do is actually set up a factory that sits idle, a factory that's capable of churning out tens of thousands of these transformers, say, per week. It'd be really expensive to build that factory. There's no way it's economically sustainable, but it's like an insurance policy. You basically have the factory up and running, keep it idle. If one of these events happen, you put it up in motion and get all the transformers out and get the power grids around the world back up and running. That could be done, but so far no government in the world has wanted to invest the money that's necessary to buy that insurance policy. But one thing this paper is pointing out, we routinely take out insurance for risks that are a lot less significant. However, another paper got published at about the same time this paper got published, basically making the point that this was an assessment based on the assumption that our star, the Sun, is like other stars that are the same mass and the same age as our star, the Sun. And the paper is basically saying that's not true, and the risk factor is at least a factor of 10 times less for our Sun than it is for these most similar Sun-like stars, which means you're only running a risk of this happening once every 20,000 years. And maybe that's more livable. But what you'll see in my article is coming out tomorrow is that isn't it amazing that we happen to be orbiting the one star where the risk is lower than anywhere else in the universe, and we happen to be living at the least risky time in the history of our Sun. And isn't it interesting that we had that Carrington event in 1859 when it had very little impact on our civilization, and right now it's not happening when we're at a significant risk. So anyway, a lay article will come out tomorrow that you can see on my Facebook page, also at reasons.org. Oh, we have somebody at the mic. Go for it.
I have a couple of questions from members of the audience. The first one is, in Matthew 23, 31, etc., it talks about us being guilty for the sins of our grandfathers. Will we be punished for the sins of our grandfathers?
Okay, good question. Will we be punished for the sins of our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents? Well, we have a promise in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 18 and chapter 32, that the son will not be punished for the sins of the father or the sins of the grandfather. The son will have to decide for himself whether he wants to submit to the authority of God over his life and spend eternity with that God or not. What you see in both Ezekiel 18 and Ezekiel 32 is that it's not what you do, it's what you do with the one that has the power to forgive you. And if you make the decision, in fact, it makes the point that you could live a very sinful life, and towards the end of your life, you repent and say, what I've done is wrong, I've displeased the God that created me, and I'm going to live the rest of my life for God, and I want to spend eternity with him. Then Ezekiel says that man will be saved. He will not be judged for any of the offenses that he has committed. But then it gives a contrast where it says there's a man who's lived a good life, has done many good works, but towards the end of his life he says, I want nothing to do with God. I don't want to spend eternity with him. I want to spend eternity without him. And he says, for that person, none of the good that he has done will be recorded or taken into account on the day of judgment. He'll be judged strictly for those things that he's done in offense to God and others. And if you read those two chapters, it was Ezekiel preaching to self-righteous Jews that were counting on all the good that they have done in their life to get them past judgment. And he says, that's not the way God judges, because they were thinking God weighs you in the balance, good deeds versus bad deeds. He says, no, God first determines what do you think of him. Do you want to spend eternity with him? And are you willing to repent of all the evil deeds that you've done and submit your life to God? If you do that, he erases all the bad deeds. You only get judged based on what's on the other side, which are your good deeds, and it's guaranteed which way it's going to go. On the other hand, if you decide you want nothing to do with God, don't want to spend eternity with him, he says all the good that you've done, that will be forgotten. You'll simply be judged based on what's on the other side. So yes, it is a weighing in the balance. But depending on what you do with the offer that God makes to every human being, he erases one side or the other. But the promise is explicit. You will not be judged for the sins of your father, your mother, your grandfather, etc. The context of Matthew 23, however, is that of a heritage. That if your fathers and grandfathers have lived a life of rebellion against God, that's a heritage you have to overcome. And so just basically making the point that there's everything to be gained from having a godly heritage. It basically puts you in a position to better recognize what God has done for you, but it will be your decision. It's not the decision of your father or your grandfather. But, you know, there's a passage in the Levitical law which basically says the sins of the parents are passed on to the children to the third and fourth generation. It also says the righteousness of the parents has passed on the children to the third and fourth generation. And that's what Jesus is referring to there in Matthew 23. We all have a heritage, but we all have the power to break from that heritage. In fact, I think what's interesting is to read Genesis 12 through 50, the story of Abraham and the next three generations. And you can see how the sins of Abraham were passed on to Isaac and Jacob and Jacob's children. But what you notice is that it was Jacob's children that broke that link. The actions of Judah and Joseph basically delivered the family from that heritage. And that's the whole point. Anybody in the heritage line at any time can break that link. We all have the free will capacity to overcome the heritage of which we're born. But yeah, it's making the point. There are benefits to being born into a godly heritage, and there are many more things to overcome if you're not. Okay, next one.
Okay, the next one, another Bible question, and it refers to Matthew 16:4. When asked for a sign, Jesus said, "None would be given except the sign of Jonah." What is that sign?
What is that sign? Well, if you read the book of Jonah, that's when God called a big sea animal to protect him after being thrown overboard by the sailors of the ship that he was on. And incidentally, Jonah asks to be thrown overboard because he says, "You know, you're all being judged account of me. Throw me overboard and you'll be okay." And indeed, they were okay. But God called this great sea animal to take him in its mouth. And there are sea animals with a mouth cavity big enough that they can protect a human being for a significant period of time. And the book of Jonah says that Jonah was in that large sea animal's mouth cavity for 3 days and three nights, then spit upon the shore where Jonah then decided, "Well, I guess I'm going to obey God and go to Nineveh after all." And he had 3 days and three nights to think about it. But that's what Jesus is referring there in that 16th chapter, that just like Jonah was in this captive space for 3 days and three nights, likewise he would be too. And it's referring to the period of time between his death on the cross and his being raised to new life. So yes, he was in the grave for 72 hours, and then he was raised to life. And that sometimes causes a controversy because, you know, we typically celebrate Good Friday, which is when he was crucified, and then we got Sunday morning. But if you add up the hours, it doesn't come to 72 hours. But a number of Bible scholars have pointed out, notice, he was crucified during Passover week. And during Passover week, you got three Sabbaths. And what the text, biblical text says is that he was crucified before one Sabbath and raised to life after the second Sabbath. And so he had to have been crucified during a week where there was a Sabbath on a Thursday and a Sabbath on a Saturday. That would give you the 72 hours that he would have been dead between the time he was killed on the cross and the time he was resurrected. And you got another question, it looks
yes.
like.
This one's physics.
Okay.
What is the evidence that there are an infinite number of universes of which ours is just one?
Okay, the evidence that there's an infinite number of universes where ours is just one, the only physical evidence is the inflation event. And, you know, the universe began infinitesimally small, and according to thermodynamics, that means it would be near infinitely hot. But God created it with the property of ongoing expansion. And as it expanded, it got colder and colder. And as it got colder and colder, the universe went through what are called symmetry breaking events. I'll give you an example you're all familiar with. You take a magnet and you heat it up. If you heat it up enough, the magnetic energy and the heat energy blend together to become just heat. And if you cool a magnet, then it splits into two forces, so you get the magnetic energy and the heat energy. Well, likewise, when our universe was first created, there was only one force of physics. And as the universe got colder and colder, that single cosmic force split into two forces, later three forces, and finally four forces. All that happened in the first billionth of a second of the existence of the universe. And during that billionth of a second, you get three symmetry breaking events. The inflation event is associated with a second symmetry breaking, where the strong electroweak force splits into the strong nuclear force and the electroweak force, which later becomes electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force. And so when the strong nuclear force splits out, that's when you get a symmetry breaking event where the universe hyperinflates, which means it expands not at the rate it's expanding today, but expands at a rate that's a million times faster, literally a million times faster than the velocity of light. And the inflation theories that are most consistent with our observations predict that that inflation event will create many, quote, bubble universes. Now, not necessarily an infinite number, In fact, what we do know by direct measurements is that the universe indeed experienced an inflation event. Exactly what kind of inflation event, we don't yet know. I'm writing about this in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos. It'll be out in just a few months' time. Basically saying we now have evidence beyond dispute that the universe did indeed have an inflation event. It's based on what we call the scalar spectral index of maps of the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event, otherwise known as a cosmic background radiation. And we get that from looking at the polarization of that radiation. And out of that, you get what's called a scalar spectral index. If there is no inflation, that index would measure to be exactly 1.0. If there is the simplest kind of inflation, it would be exactly 0.95. If it's complex inflation, it'll be between 0.96 and 0.97. You say, well, where do the measurements lie right now? I forget the exact number, but I think it's something like 0.9609 plus or minus 0.0065, which is not enough to rule out simple inflation, but it is enough to rule out no inflation, and more likely, it's complex inflation. But to answer that question, you know, how many universes are involved in the cosmic inflation event? The answer is we don't know until we get a better measure of that scalar spectral index. And would also help if we could see the gravitational waves from the cosmic creation event. The good news is there are several instruments at the South Pole that are busy attempting to measure both. And I'm predicting that within 2 years or less, they'll be able to give us a much more accurate picture of the cosmic inflation event. But all I can tell you right now, there's more than one space-time realm than our universe. There might be a whole lot more. There could even be an infinite number. We just simply don't know. So wait a couple of years and come back here. Hopefully I'll be able to give you a better answer.
Next question.
Good morning, Dr. Ross and everybody. Wow, that was quite an answer. Appreciate that. Dr. Ross, I've learned so much from you and the others in the class here, and a lot of my questions have been answered. I happen to believe that everybody should share their faith, share the gospel, but not necessarily everybody has to share apologetics. So my questions are this. First of all, where do you think apologetics fit into the Christian lifestyle? And then second of all, I'm a street preacher. What do you think of street preaching? I'm not trying to draw attention to myself, but just as a method of sharing the gospel, what do you think of street preaching?
Okay, a couple of good questions. Your first one again was...
The role of apologetics in the Christian lifestyle.
Well, let me give a definition. Apologetics comes from 1 Peter 3:15, which states, always be ready to give good reasons for the hope that you have in Jesus Christ with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. So it's basically a command to followers of Jesus Christ to develop those good reasons, but be prepared to share them with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. And the role of apologetics is based on that good reasons part. And if you go to Hebrews 11:6, it says, anyone who comes to God must believe that he exists, and he rewards those who earnestly seek him. And, you know, you made a good point. Sometimes you don't need apologetics. So, for example, you had Bill Bright founding the Campus Crusade Ministry. And back in the 50s and 60s, it was based on presenting your Christian faith with a little booklet called The Four Spiritual Laws. Well, the first law was, God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. And back in the 50s and 60s, you could count on at least 90% of the students on the campus as believing that. Then you could just go on. But today, if you are on the university campus, the majority of students and professors don't believe that. They basically don't believe Hebrews 11:6. And so the role of apologetics is to establish that first spiritual law, that there really is a God out there, and it's a God that loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. or as Hebrews 11:6 says, God exists and he wants to reward those who earnestly seek him. And so apologetics is basically coming up with the evidences from science and history and philosophy that indeed such a God exists. And once you persuade people that that's the case, then you can take them forward and say, okay, here's how you can come into a relationship with that God. So yes, for people already believe that God's out there and has does want to reward them as they earnestly seek him, then it's simply a matter of showing them how they can come into a relationship. But for people who don't believe that, they're going to need some sound evidences, some sound reasons to believe that that's the case. And your second question was the role of street preaching. I've got a book coming out probably in late 2018 based on 1 Peter 3:15, but I tell a short story there of a personal encounter I had with a street preacher. And it was in downtown Vancouver. My parents, who weren't believers at the time, were taking us to a department store in downtown Vancouver, and we walked by the street preacher. I heard maybe 15 seconds of his preaching. My parents were yanking me away. But what I heard in those 15 seconds years later bore some fruit. Just those few words made me curious about passages in the Bible he's talking about. And it was at age 17 I began to study those passages. So you never know what kind of impact that can have. On the other hand, I've also heard some street preachers that really weren't practicing the second part of 1 Peter 3:15, which is you make the presentation with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. I've seen many street preachers that were kind of the opposite of that. And so don't be arrogant when you're sharing your faith. Okay, next.
Hello, Dr. Ross. Are you familiar with the ministry of Pastor Arnold Murray on the Shepherd's Chapel Network?
I am not, so you're going to have to give me the context.
He passed away a few years ago. And on the Shepherd's Chapel Network, Pastor Arnold Murray taught some things that some Bible scholars thought were heretical, and I just wanted your feedback on it. In his ministry, he taught something that was called the first, the second, and the third Earth Age.
The first, second, and third what?
Earth Age.
Earth Age, okay.
And the first Earth Age was, I guess, the first couple chapters of Genesis. And then, because he also talks about in Peter how there's a day is a thousand years, a thousand years is to a day. And then, so, scripturally, scientifically, just from your point of view, do you know what he's talking about in his ministry?
Yeah, I now know what you're talking
about. In the first, second, or third Earth Age?
And it's not just him. There are lots of Bible scholars and theologians that are promoting this viewpoint. And the viewpoint is that you've got phase one of the earth, which is before Adam and Eve sinned against God. And then when they sinned against God, there are curses pronounced upon them and upon the earth. And they believe that the earth changed in some respect. And then Jesus is going to come back and bring it back to the conditions it had before Adam and Eve sinned. This often goes by, there's two different kinds of restoration theology, so I want to be careful with the terminology, but this is a reference to how, you know, God intends to restore the earth to the conditions that Adam and Eve enjoyed in the Garden of Eden before they sinned against God. And if you go back, well, probably a couple of weeks, I wrote a blog article. You can see it on our reasons.org site and also on Facebook, where I basically critiqued that viewpoint from a biblical perspective and a scientific perspective. And what's happening, these people are reading passages in the Bible which would say that the stars will burn forever and the earth is going to last forever. And my whole point was, before you draw a conclusion based on those texts, you need to read everything that the Bible says on that subject. And what I first pointed out is that word forever, it's olam in the Hebrew, and it can indeed mean for all of eternity. But equivalently, it can mean for just a long time. That same word is used of the Aaronic priesthood, that it's going to last a long time. Well, the Aaronic priesthood was done away with 2,000 years ago. It did indeed last a long time, but it wasn't all eternity. And so just be aware that in biblical Hebrew, there is no term that only means eternity. There's this word olam that can mean either one, eternity or a long time. That's important because there are over a dozen places in the Old Testament where it tells us that the stars will disappear, they will vanish, they will be no more, and the universe likewise will disappear, the earth will disappear. And so if the earth disappears, we can't be spending eternity here on earth. It's got to be a new earth that's completely distinct from the universe, because if God's going to speak the universe away, then it can't be this earth. And I've also been pointing out to my theology friends that if you really think it's this earth, it's got a rather limited carrying capacity. And are you aware you're limiting the number of people who are going to be saved? And based on Jesus' words, it's not going to be a small number that will be redeemed. Likewise, Revelation 7:9 tells us it will be a countless number. And in that case, this present planet is simply too small to house the redeemed in the state that God intends to house them, with all the rewards he intends to bestow. So, I would argue that this is counter to what the Bible teaches. It's also counter to what the record of nature teaches us. We've just been talking about the sun here, and there will come a time when the sun's going to flare a lot more than it's flaring now, and that won't be too far into the future. And when that happens, it'll simply be impossible for humans and human civilization to be here on the earth. In fact, I've written an improbable planet. A day is coming relatively soon when photosynthesis can no longer be sustained on the earth. And without photosynthesis, you simply can't feed a large human population or the animals on which we depend upon. And that's just one of many reasons. In fact, my sons were asking me, you know, long term, what's going to happen to the earth? And I says, well, the sun's going to get brighter and brighter, and eventually get bright enough it'll turn planet Earth into a charcoal briquette, and eventually it'll completely incinerate the earth. It'll be vaporized. And they said, when's that going to happen? I said, well, 4 billion years from now. That's a long ways into the future, but it's not eternity. And so this planet Earth simply can't be our eternal home for many more reasons than I got the time to talk about here. But, hey, you can check the article I wrote. Okay, next.
Good morning, Dr. Ross.
Good morning.
Thank you. First, an observation, a quick one, and then I have a small, quick question. As you probably know by now, that according to my Bible, Scientific American, what's his name, that spacecraft, spacecraft crashed into Saturn
Weeks back. Cassini mission, right.
Cassini. Crashed into Saturn a few years back. There's two moons going around it, and one is called Titan, and the other one is Enceladus.
Right.
I just wanted to let everybody know that they've discovered two new moons around there called Rice and Beans.
And your question is? Okay, well, no, I can give you some context to that.
I got a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
The question is, I don't know the chapter and verse of that. I used to know it because I've been reading it for a long time. But it's where Jesus is standing in a crowd, and he says, there are some of you standing here who will not have died before I come again in all my glory, or whatever. You probably know
right.
Verbatim.
Matthew 24.
Now, I was talking with somebody about that the other day, and is that what you don't hear about that too much from preachers, even on TV. When I watch them, they never mention that word or those words that Jesus said to his disciples and or people around him. Why is that?
Okay, well, again, that's been a big debate that I've seen on my Facebook page, because I've been bombarded with a bunch of preterists. If you're not familiar with that term, a preterist is someone who believes all the prophecies in the Olivet Discourse, which would be Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, were fulfilled in 70 AD. And there will be no future fulfillment of the prophecies in these three texts. And the extreme preterists believe that Jesus actually returned in 70 AD in spirit form, basically his spirit in embodying the church and how the church is going to take over and establish a theocracy on the face of the earth. So what are called partial preterists and then full preterists. So there's these two different positions. But it's all based on this text that you're referring to in Matthew 24, where they said, hey, it says that once the temple is destroyed, that's it. Jesus will return when that happens. Now, what they're failing to understand is that when you look at the beginning of Matthew 24, the disciples ask two questions, not one question. One question they ask is, they're amazed at the temple. And they said, well, Jesus responds and says, a day is coming when there will not be one stone upon another. This temple will be destroyed. And they said, well, when's that going to happen? And when are you going to return? And he basically gave this Olivet Discourse. But notice there are two questions. When will the temple be destroyed? And when will you come back? And, you know, my response to the preterists is, based on many examples we have in the Old Testament, why can't Jesus, in his prophecy here in Matthew 24 and Luke 21 and Mark 13, give a prophecy that's fulfilled at two different times? I'll give you an example from the Old Testament. In the book of Isaiah, Isaiah prophesies that a virgin will give birth to a son. But if you read that text, Isaiah 7, it's referring to two different virgins with two different sons with two different names. And virgin number one is the woman to whom Isaiah is betrothed. They're not yet married. But he says, you will be married, and that virgin will give birth to the son after you're married, and his name will be Mahal Shalhal Hashbaz. Repeat that after me. Okay. But then he goes on to talk about another virgin who will give birth to a child and how his name will be Emmanuel, the one who will save us all from our sins. And this is typical of the Old Testament prophets. They would give short-range predictions to persuade their audience that their long-range predictions will come true. And what it says about Mahar Shalhal Hashbaz, it says by the time the boy is old enough to be able to speak and know right from wrong, these Assyrians that are threatening to destroy the nation of Judah will be wiped out and will no longer be a threat to you. And that happened within 2 years. And so the people got to say, hey, what Isaiah said actually came true. This vast army of Assyrians, which we had no hope to defeat, all wound up getting sick the night before the battle. A whole bunch of them died, and they retreated and left us alone. And they said, you know, if Isaiah is right on that one, he's probably right, almost certainly right, on the long-range prediction. Well, likewise, what we see here in Matthew is similar. Jesus gives a short-range prediction. This temple will be destroyed. And in the lifetime of those disciples, indeed, that had happened. And basically what Matthew 24 is saying, these are the things that will be signs that this is about to happen. And the generation that sees those signs will see the fulfillment. Well, indeed, the preterists are right. If you go back to the decades just before 70 AD, everything predicted here in Matthew 24 happened. You know, there were earthquakes in diverse places, there were famines, etc. Everything here was fulfilled. And literally the generation that saw all those things also saw the destruction of the second temple. But then he's talking about a different generation, a second generation much later that will see all these signs being fulfilled again. And basically the promise is the generation that sees those signs will still be alive when Jesus returns bodily. That has not yet happened. But the whole point is we can have confidence it will happen because we saw that it happened within the decades after the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. And so we can be confident that this is a future fulfillment that must happen just as precisely as the first one, because look how wonderfully and accurately the first one was fulfilled. Now, the preterists jumped all over me when I put this up on my Facebook page, and they said, nowhere in the Bible do you see double prophecies. Well, I think they're wrong. There's many places in the Bible where you see double prophecies. And the prophets frequently made short-range predictions, typically 1-2 years ahead, and then they made long-range predictions. And that's how these people established. That's why these books in the Old Testament got included as part of the canon, is because they were so rigorously accurate in their short-term predictions that people said their long-term predictions will come true as well. And the standard that you see in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses said many prophets will come. Most of them will be false prophets, but some of them will be true prophets. The sign of a true prophet, everything that prophet predicts comes true without error. And that's why these prophets would give short-range predictions to establish that indeed they really were a true prophet of God. Because everyone else in the context of Isaiah was saying, we're going to get wiped out by the Assyrians. He says, nope, I go against the majority. It's not going to happen. God's going to save you, and it's going to happen before this boy knows right from wrong and is able to talk. And indeed, all that happened in a very miraculous way. Okay, next.
Hey, Dr. Ross. I was reading Aaron Wall's blog a couple weeks ago, and someone posed a question to him, which I think is a really good question on a broader level, on a broader scale. Someone asked him if bad historians are in danger of hellfire. So basically people who read the Bible, read history, and for whatever reason are unconvinced of Christ's resurrection and all of the theology that goes along with that. And that got me thinking on a larger level is, you know, people who are Hindus or Muslims or, you know, even atheists who either don't hear the word of God or hear it, and because they're constrained by their culture, where they are in time and space, they're unconvinced. In the same sense that, you know, if a rival religion walked into this room right now, we would you know, meet them with resistance. Where does God's mercy and God's grace fit into the picture here, if it does at all?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I've traveled around the world speaking to different audiences, and I find that when I'm overseas, say, addressing an audience of Hindu students, they tend to be quite a bit more receptive to my Christian message than students I run into on the American campus. So sometimes being raised in a Christian context can be a bigger barrier than being raised in a non-Christian context. I mean, I remember speaking at a university in Durban. This is during the days of apartheid, where they had a special university just for students of Indian descent, and the vast majority were Hindus. And I told them that because they were incredibly receptive to my message. We had a huge number give their lives to Christ. And their comment afterwards as I talked to them is, well, because we're studying science and engineering here, we knew that the Hindu worldview was wrong. And so we just had this gut feeling there's something wrong with what we've been taught. And their comment is, we think it's harder for students raised in a Christian home because they're so close to the truth, it's harder for them to see the error. And they made an interesting point. All of us are raised in a context where we're taught errors. I don't care how godly your parents were, how committed they were to Jesus Christ. And I've told this to my sons. Look, you need to test everything I share with you because I'm human. Not everything I'm sharing is right on. You need to find out where the truth is and where the error is. It was Paul who said in Thessalonians, everything must be tested. Test everything. Hold fast to that which is good. But it's easier to discern that something is false if it's really far away from the truth. So, you know, in fact, the first religion I looked at was Hinduism. And what I realized is it tells us that the universe reincarnates with a cycle of 4.32 billion years. And I said, I know enough about physics, even as a 17-year-old, to realize that can't possibly be true. And therefore, this idea that we humans reincarnate, that can't be true either. But, you know, it was so much away from the truth that it was easier for me to quickly see the errors and move on to another religion. Buddhism was harder for me to eliminate because it's closer to the Christian worldview than the Hinduism is. In fact, I've met Buddhists when I was in Hong Kong who were Trinitarian. But they did tell me they got that from the Bible. They didn't get it from their Hindu worldview. Buddhism is like that. It easily blends different religions together. So it's a little more challenging for people in the Buddhist background. So the answer to the question is, God gives every one of us the capability of discerning truth from error, and basically makes the point, if you decide to follow truth as opposed to following error, God will see to it that you receive more of that truth. It's actually something we're studying in the Paradoxes class on Sunday morning, what you see in the First Chronicles 29, that God knows your thoughts, he knows the motives behind your thoughts, and if you seek after him, he will find you. He will find a way to reveal more truth to you, but you need to take the first step. And that first step is, I want to find the truth. I want to find out what's true and what's false. And God's given each of us the capability to do that. Okay, next question.
I have a question from online, but I'm going to have a little predicate before that. Both you and Fuzz Rana have talked about in the Origin of Life community how there seems to be less evidence all the time for the origin of life and that it looks more supernatural all the time. We have an online question from a live stream viewer in Antelope Valley who wants to know if you would give a prediction. Is the theory of evolution, do you think, as more evidence come in, do you think the scientific community will also likewise start realizing that there's significant problems in the theory of evolution as far as one species evolving to another one, or will they continue to focus on microevolution as proof for that theory?
Okay, there's a difference here between the data and the worldview. And so, yeah, what I'm predicting is that the data will increasingly rule against a naturalistic model for the origin of life and a naturalistic explanation for the history of life from that first life up to human beings. However, I'm also predicting that that's not going to have much impact on the worldview of a research scientist. And that's just simply based on what we see in the Bible, where it tells us that the majority of human beings will choose to live a life apart from God in spite of the evidence. You see that in the book of Romans, chapter 1, that God has clearly revealed evidence, but most human beings choose to ignore that evidence. It's what the Bible refers to as self-imposed ignorance. It's not that we don't have the facts, it's not that we don't have the data. We choose to ignore that data, we ignore those facts, or we reinterpret those facts and that data to fit our worldview. Now, people have asked me then, how come it is that most scientists agree with you on Big Bang cosmology? After all, that testifies of a God beyond space and time that created everything. You seem to have lots of secular support for that worldview, but nowhere near that kind of secular support for your view on the origin of human beings. Well, my answer is what Romans 1 tells us about the nature of human beings to rebel against the authority of God. That's going to have less influence when you're talking about the origin of the universe. Because now we're talking about something 13.8 billion years ago. We're talking about galaxies that are 13 billion light years away. You're literally able to hold God at arm's length. And in fact, I would tell you that most of the scientists I engage are not atheists or agnostics. Most of them are deists, where they believe that there is some kind of God that created everything 13.8 billion years ago, but ever since then he's been taking a very long nap. He really pays no attention to what's going on afterwards. He lets natural process do everything. But the question is, does the data really support a deistic worldview? And, you know, the ministry that I helped found Reasons to Believe, our whole point is it can explain some, but it certainly can't explain all. There definitely is natural process going on. that God set up, but God must supernaturally intervene, particularly at the origin of life. And what I do see in the scientific literature, and you'll see this documented in my book, Improbable Planet, and I'm guessing it's over there in the table, where I take the example of the Avalon and Cambrian explosions. And that's when our planet transitions from only microbial life to where you've got big plants and big animals, as big as 2 meters across. And now these plants and animals show up out of nowhere. They just suddenly come upon the scene. So you go from microbes to this very complex system of big plants and animals and an optimized ecology, literally instantaneously, as instantaneous as we can measure it in the fossil record. And it coincides with what we call the Great Unconformity, where there's a massive chemical transformation of the world's oceans, and also where they see the oxygen in the atmosphere jump from less than 1% to 8 and 10%, which literally makes possible for the first time these plants and animals. But the moment you got the chemical transformation, immediately you see these animals. Well, what you'll see in Improbable Planet is I cite review papers written by secular paleontologists and evolutionary biologists. None of these individuals are believers, and yet they comment on the impossibility of trying to interpret this evidence, the data, from a naturalistic perspective. Now, they don't say that, you know, and I'm now a Christian. What they're basically saying is the more we learn about the Cambrian explosion, the more difficult and intractable it is to try to comport that with a naturalistic explanation. The more we learn, the harder it gets, and it's been impossible for a few decades.
Hugh, I think this is a good time for
the drawing.
For the drawing and for a question. So we're gonna kill two birds with one stone here. So the way we're gonna do this is if you have a card with your information filled out that you'd like to turn in so that we can put you in the drawing, please just raise it up in the air. I will collect it while Hugh Ross answers the following question, which is a question from the audience, which is, what research this past year have you found most compelling regarding God's existence?
Interesting question. I probably can think of, I'll mention one, and maybe I'll talk about it tomorrow, the second one. And this one actually will show up in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos. And, you know, the atheistic physics community has really been promoting what they call the era of ignorance. And that's the era between the creation of the universe and 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the creation of the universe. And that's what, 1/10 millionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the creation of the universe. And indeed, that's an era where we lack the instrumentation to measure the physical conditions of the universe. You know, as one astrophysicist put it, we would need a particle accelerator the length of the distance from here to the most distant galaxy to be able to explore the physics of that region. And the likelihood of that being funded in a Republican administration is rather remote. So, and so what you have are these physicists basically saying, well, since it's impossible for us to investigate that era, we're free to speculate. And they've been speculating that that's where you're going to have quantum space-time fluctuations so very large that it opens up the possibility that maybe there was no cosmic creation event. It's a way to escape the beginning. And the person who's really pushing that idea lives just a few miles from here. It's Sean Carroll at Caltech, a very outspoken atheist. And he's published what he calls the quantum eternity theorem, where he says it's not what Christians say, where there's this beginning 14 billion years ago. The universe is actually eternal. But he's appealing to the unknown and speculating that there's these enormous quantum space-time fluctuations that exist in this era of ignorance that would allow us to escape a beginning. Now, even if you take his theorem at face value, it doesn't really work, because he's postulating there's an infinite period of contraction before the current expansion of the universe. And as the theistic physicist Roger Penrose pointed out, you can't fit the geometry of the contracting universe to the geometry of the expanding universe. It doesn't work. However, there is a discovery made just a few months ago that actually says there is a way we can explore that era of ignorance. And it's by looking at the images of distant quasars and blazars, because those images blur as they travel through space that's dependent on how big the quantum space-time fluctuations are. The bigger those quantum space-time fluctuations are, the blurrier the images of distant quasars and blazars become, in proportion to the distance the light beam travels and in inverse proportion to the wavelength of that light. So what astronomers have done beginning about 10 months ago is they began looking at the images of distant quasars and blazars at relatively short wavelengths to put that to the test. And basically they've concluded that the quantum gravity models that are needed to sustain the quantum eternity theorem are ruled out. So for example, the random walk quantum gravity models are completely ruled out. And probably all, most if not all, of what are called the holographic quantum gravity models. Basically, they're saying the quantum gravity fluctuations are too small to sustain the theorem, and small enough that it sustains, someone here just mentioned Aaron Wall. He's a young theoretical physicist who's a Christian. He's got a great blog site, and he published a space-time theorem basically saying if the quantum space-time fluctuations are small enough, then that's the space-time theorems hold rigorously throughout the quantum gravity era. And basically these new observations are sustaining his theorem and contradicting the theorem of Sean Carroll. Anyway, I got that all written up in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, so you'll see that in a little while. But and incidentally, I state in that book, that's not going to be the end of atheistic speculations. They're simply going to find another area of ignorance that they can speculate about. But it does demonstrate a principle. The more we learn about the universe, the stronger the evidence becomes for a Christian worldview of the universe. And that's just one example. We learned something we didn't know before, and guess what direction it went philosophically and theologically. But if you're waiting, like Sean Carroll is, for Christians to eliminate all possibility of doubt, that'll never happen. We're human beings. There will always be things we don't know. And often that's what an atheist will tell you. I'm not going to believe until all possible atheistic speculations are done away with. That'll never happen. And the same reason that all the speculations that the flat earth community comes up with can't be eliminated either. And no matter how much we learn about the earth, you're still going to have a case for the flat earth proposition, just that it's not going to be a very realistic case. So I still feel good about getting on an airplane and have it traveling in a curve.
All right, you're mixing these up. There's a good defender of fidelity and randomness. And you get to make the selection. Call out the name and I'll bring them up. So when your name is called, just come on up. We have three persons.
Okay. Looks like Heath or Keith Whittier. Maybe you can read it.
Okay, let me get my young man glasses on.
All right. Yeah.
How about Thomas White?
Thomas White, wow. That was close. All right. I might have to get out my flashlight on this one. Yeah. not sure this has got a name. Check it out. I may have to pick another one.
Marlene Wolfberg. Thank you all very much. One thing to remember is that whatever information you give us doesn't get sold, doesn't get given away to anybody else. It's kept within just to believe only. And it's used to contact you later on if you have any interest in having us contact you later on.
Okay, here's a question for all of you. What's the probability that these three people all sitting right next to one another would have all won these randomly shuffled cards? There you go. Okay, we got another person at the microphone. Go for it.
Yes, I've long been wondering about the risk to the power grid in the event of an electron flux in the atmosphere. And I understand the failure mode on the transformers is saturation of the core from an anomalous DC current, and that the failure probably takes place in probably more than a few seconds. It might be several seconds. And there's be very simple to design and test and install disconnect devices that could isolate up to 500,000 volts and activate in less than 1 second for less than $10,000 a line. And I'm just wondering why, with all the discussion of this risk, that if you know of any reason why, or if there's some flaw in the thinking, to be able to install protective devices in the system would be retrofitted easily.
Well, one thing that has been suggested is, because when you see one of these coronal mass ejections, you got about 20 to 24 hours advance notice. It's going to take that long for the ejection to impact our magnetosphere. What's challenging, however, is when you see the coronal mass ejection, the sun, you really can't calculate accurately whether it's going to hit our magnetosphere or not. Most of them will miss, and if they miss, there's no big deal. But you know, if you can determine, hey, it's got a high likelihood of hitting, one option you have is just shut down the power grids all over the world. Just shut them down, wait for the thing to pass, and start them up again. The problem with that proposal, however, is that society is rather dependent on having power. It's one thing to have power down for a few minutes, but to have power down for several days, that's what you have to do. You have to shut it down for at least 3 days before you fire it back up. And having no power for 3 days worldwide would have very serious consequences. So basically, in fact, there was a paper, you can read it online. It's about a 20-page report that you can read online about the consequences of one of these coronal mass ejection events, and basically said there's no cheap way around it. You're going to have some serious consequences one way or another. But yes, it would be less consequential just to shut down the power grid for 3 days than to have lots, tens of millions of people without power for 2 years. Well, but that's one reason why they said, maybe a better option is just to have a factory basically just sitting idle until this risk shows up. Then you can just turn out the transformers one after the other. So you can read it and see what they say. Maybe you can actually write the government and tell them a better solution. But that's what they came up with so far.
Hi. When I was younger, I prayed for truth, and I was reading in the Bible that the truth would set you free. And long story short, Jehovah's Witnesses came by, and I ended up being one of those for 20 years. But as I matured and I studied, I find a lot of the things that they believed weren't really true or not in the Bible, so I became a Christian. And another 20 years studying theology and trying to put everything together, I find within the Christian community this idea of young earth and old earth. And 2 weeks ago, I went to an event here in Pasadena that was sponsored through Ken Ham, and they have a different interpretation of you know, they believe in the 7 days. And I recently went to Grand Canyon and Bryce and Utah, and I said, this really looks old, and it doesn't look like it would happen in a flood event. So why is there so many? Why is there a different interpretation between old Earth and young Earth?
Okay, good question. A couple of the books we gave away actually dealt with that subject. And 2 weeks from today, approximately 2 weeks from today, there'll be a book released called Four Views on Creation, Evolution, and Intelligent Design. And it involves Ken Ham. He's one of the authors. Represent the young Earth view. I represent the old Earth creationist view. You got Deborah Harzma representing evolutionary creationism, and then Steve Meyer represents the intelligent design movement. That book will really tell you where the four different groups stand and why. And, you know, I was pleased to be part of the book because I've been misrepresented by members of all three groups, and this is just a chance to kind of say, hey, this is where we really stand and why. Interestingly, all four groups said that they believed in biblical inerrancy, but all four groups had very different definitions of biblical inerrancy. So just to be clear, at Reasons to Believe, we hold the biblical inerrancy as is defined by the International Council of Biblical Inerrancy. But that's not the case with the others. So they have very different definitions. As to why we still have this old Earth, young Earth thing going on, that's a good question. When my wife and I launched Reasons to Believe 32 years ago, I was thinking at most this young Earth view is going to disappear within 2 years. It's still here. But as I've engaged young Earth creationists like Ken Ham, and you can watch debates I've done with Ken Ham. We have video recordings of them. What I realize is that they wed their young Earth belief to doctrines that are core to the Christian faith. So, for example, they have publicly accused me of denying the doctrine of the atonement. And, you know, that's a big core doctrine of the Christian faith, the idea that, you know, God has atoned for all of our sins. But what they have interpreted is that the doctrine of atonement demands that no animal was having its blood shed until Adam sinned. And, you know, my position is plants and animals were consuming one another long before Adam sinned. And, you know, deer were running into thorns, and dogs were having their feet scratched as they went over sharp stones. That was going on long before Adam sinned. And I don't see that as having any impact on the doctrine of atonement at all, based on what you see in Hebrews 9 and 10, which states that the sacrificial offerings of goats and doves and cows has no benefit for the atonement for human sin. The only blood that atones is the blood of the creator of the universe, Jesus Christ. The blood of goats and cows that were sacrificed by the Jews before Jesus came to earth were symbols of the blood that would atone. But young Earth creationists see it as more than just symbols. And because they think that their young Earth position is basically a plank of the gospel, they say there can be no give or take. They basically think salvation is at stake if you got a wrong view of the age of the Earth, which is the reason why we had one of these books here, which is called Controversy of the Ages, Why Christians Shouldn't Divide Over the Age of the Earth. And notice that the age of the earth is not in any of the creeds of the church. Now, I think it's an important doctrine because I think we got very good evidence from the book of nature that indeed the earth and the universe are billions of years old. And I think we got good evidence from the Bible that the days of creation must be consecutive long periods of time. But it's not an issue on which my salvation hangs. And that's one thing that the authors of this book noted. The people of an old earth perspective don't see this as a salvation issue at all, but young earth creationists do. And because of that, they're not willing to consider alternative interpretations. So I think my wife is right. It's not going to go away even 2 years from now. It's going to be around.
Hugh, you've been known in the past to come up with booklets that said the greatest scientific discoveries that support, you know, the Bible and the God of the Bible. And since there's 2 months left in this year, we want people want to sneak. Someone here in this audience wants a sneak preview for 2017. What do you think was the greatest scientific discovery that that validates the existence of the biblical God?
Well, I just shared one of those discoveries, namely the images of distant quasars and blazars, and how that impacts speculations that maybe there's no beginning if we take we speculate about what's going on in the quantum gravity era. For number two, probably what happened a few weeks ago, it was October 16th, where they announced that they now had found gravitational waves from the merger of two neutron stars. And I've made two posts on my Facebook page, one for the geeks and one for the rest of the population. And that lay version just went up yesterday, or I think, no, I put it up on Friday. So, and it's got some pretty pictures basically showing you where this event took place. Got a little video clip where you can see what it looks like. But the exciting thing about this discovery, number one, it's the first time astronomers have ever observed the merging of two neutron stars. And it's two neutron stars that are orbiting one another. And Einstein's theory of general relativity tells us if you've got two neutron stars orbiting one another, they will radiate gravitational waves, which will cause them to get closer and closer together, and eventually they merge to become a black hole. And at the moment of merging, it sends out very powerful gravitational waves that our instruments are able to detect. But because it was two neutron stars merging together as opposed to two black holes, you could also see it at other wavelengths. You know, when two black holes merge together, you got two things that are black merging and become something that's black. You really don't see any electromagnetic radiation. But because neutron stars are not black holes, when they merge together, you get this huge shower of neutrons as they merge to become a black hole, and that allows you to see radiation at all wavelengths. And so astronomers were anticipating that eventually you would see one of these, so they were ready. As soon as the merging was announced by the LIGO and Virgo gravitational wave observatories, astronomers around the world jumped on it and began to make measurements at all different wavelengths. And I was mentioning this in the Paradoxes class a couple of weeks ago. This discovery ranks as the greatest scientific collaboration of all time. 952 research institutes were involved in studying this event. Over 4,600 astronomers had their names appended to the research papers. That adds up to one-third of the entire population of research astronomers in the world. And then a whole bunch of physicists jumped in, too. So by far the greatest scientific collaboration of all time. And there's speculation that maybe this will be a Nobel Prize-winning event. We'll see how that turns out. When I wrote about it, I said, this also explains where we get our uranium and thorium and where we get our platinum group metals. You say, what do we need all that for? Well, our planet Earth is super endowed with uranium and thorium at a rate for the thorium that ranks 630 times above the average for rocky planets, and for uranium, 340 times. And so that's something you can think about when you go home today. We're living on the most uranium-thorium-rich body probably in the entire universe. But it's because our planet is so super endowed with uranium and thorium that we don't have a...